Welcome to the Big Dog Crypto Podcast. This is your number one crypto podcast to hear directly from the movers and shakers, innovators and disruptors in the cryptocurrency industry. Follow on Twitter for updates and to communicate directly at Woof Big Dog. That's at Woof Big D-A-W-G. Now, here is your host, the one and only Big Dog Crypto.
And welcome to the latest episode of the Big Dog Crypto Podcast. I'm your host, Big Dog Crypto. Today has been a very interesting day in the digital asset and crypto space. And I have Joe Carlosari on with me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Patrick. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate having you on. Now, you were the first individual I've had on the podcast that I could talk legal to, because obviously this is your background. Please, yes. If you could kind of give a little explanation to the space of what you do and how you got into it as far as from the legal aspect in crypto.
Sure. So I am a full-time practicing commercial litigator based out of the law firm of Amundsen Davis in Chicago. I'm co-chair of our FinTech cryptocurrency and blockchain practice group. I am the litigation half of the practice group. I represent individuals in all real aspects of the whole crypto industry, everything from miners that are operating, setting up businesses to people involved in disputes against token issuers, disputes defending suits against token issuers, people that have been perhaps wronged by some of the fraudulent activity in the space. So I've been involved in cryptocurrency, blockchain, Bitcoin really since 2015. Really just started to get involved as an investor before there really was a legal space, It was kind of, people say it's the wild, wild west these days. It was definitely the wild west back then. I mean, you had sparse guidance, if any, and we kind of just had to figure it out as we were going along. And I met some folks that were very sort of at the cutting edge in the legal space and sort of partnered with them. And most of the early lawyers in the space were really trying to deal with cryptocurrency from a taxation standpoint. And then, my observation at the time, just as a market participant, as someone holding Bitcoin and passionate about the underlying, promise of what Bitcoin represented, was that, well, if this works out, if this blows up and becomes a huge space, I'm going to be having a lot of litigation, a lot of disputes, right? Because anything that's fast moving and is making overnight millionaires, there are people that stick their hand up and say, well, this money was stolen from me or this was wronged. And, So I basically got into the space knowing that, there's going to be a whole lot of individuals that are going to craft what was put in place from a legal perspective. And I've been very fortunate, with my practice to have a lot of interesting cases early on. We got an order, one of the first orders, I think, in Cook County, compelling assets on chain to be turned over, which was really interesting back in the early days when you're trying to explain what a distributed ledger was to a court and that had, basically very limited technological background and expertise. So, it's been a great ride, and I think it's only going to go up from here and definitely be interesting times ahead with all that's going on from a legal and litigation standpoint.
But that's interesting, because I have a couple of friends that, attorney friends that are into crypto and they love it. They really just started learning about it in the past couple of years. You're saying 2015, so you've got almost nine years in the space. I mean, that's pretty fast. I mean, you've seen a lot of stuff. I mean, we're talking, I mean, what, Mt. Gox was a little bit before that, or what was that, 13, 14? Or
13,
I mean,
you've 14, been, yeah.
That's a lot almost in 8 or 9, 10 years,
Yeah, it's been a lot. And it's interesting to me because, I don't think many would have guessed that we'd be sitting here 9 years into the space, billion-dollar assets, major institutions coming in, and we still wouldn't have had regulatory clarity on a lot of important issues, basic issues, right? Like custody, what it means to be a compliant custodian in the space. I know there are folks out there that claim to be or purport to be, but I know there are regulators that strongly disagree with that. So if you would have asked younger Joe a long time ago, would you think that in 2023, 2024, we wouldn't have more clarity on some of these subjects? I would have said, no, we'll absolutely have it by then. That's a long ways away. But it's one of those things where it never quite takes the path you'd expect. And I think the surprise of many in this industry have been that really there's been regulators who have been as hands-off as they have been pretty much until the recent past couple of years, where they really started to ramp up enforcement actions.
Well, speaking of that enforcement actions, obviously today was a really big day in the space. You know, I've always thanked on Twitter, you know, been on Twitter since 2017, and I've always thanked CZ for coming on the first podcast. He took his time, and I appreciate that. So I've always just been very positive and supportive. And I thank you. Anybody that takes the time to come on the podcast, we all know that's everybody's most valuable asset. I appreciate that. That being said, today was a pretty big day for CZ and for Binance. And I saw your tweet, and I kind of want to bring it up and talk about it in the news about the potential $4 billion settlement. Now, I think, or you did the tweet. So I kind of want to ask you, what are your thoughts on that? As far as, is he just going to pay $4 billion? Is there an indictment? Does he say, here it is, give him to pay less? What are your thoughts on that?
I have many thoughts. So let's go back. We have to start with the reporting that was made. I think there were a little bit of whispers as much as a year ago. And then there's some additional reporting that came out in the early part of this year that there was an active Department of Justice investigation. And as much as there's a lot of focus in our space about what the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, or the CFTC does, you got to remember for listeners that there's a huge divide between criminal and civil. If you put the DOJ criminal on one side and put civil authorities, civil suits by private individuals, the SEC, civil suits and are mostly ones where you're seeking disgorgement, you're seeking recovery of ill-gotten gains, you're trying to compensate victims. It's mostly money damages. But the complexion of it really changes when you move into criminal. Criminal is where they take away your freedom, and obviously, you know, that's where the serious charges lie. So the reason I bring that up is because usually what happens is the criminal almost always take precedent over the civil. Okay, if you've got multiple different agencies, multiple regulators investigating something, usually the civil regulators, they take a backseat to the criminal. And what we heard early on were some whispers about an active DOJ investigation, that they were trying to build a case against Binance. Perhaps they didn't get the smoking gun they hoped for in a case against Binance. But then everything sort of was thrown for a loop when the SEC filed a case not only against Binance, but also against Coinbase. And the SEC, and then the CFTC also filed a case pending out by me in the Northern District of Illinois against Binance and the US and the international entity. So I think, Mark, a lot of practitioners like myself were sort of confused when that happened, because usually what would happen is, again, criminal takes precedent, they lead the charge, and the cleanup comes from the civil authorities. So there's a couple of reasons why that might have been, why the SEC chose to sort of go it alone without a criminal investigation. Number one, most notably, is the fact that maybe the DOJ hadn't wrapped its investigation. Maybe they needed additional documents, additional records to really build the case against Binance. Maybe they had sort of some information to bring a case, but they didn't feel quite comfortable yet until the SEC moved forward. And they likely gave the green light to the SEC to go file that suit against Binance and try to seek records, which is part and parcel of the SEC suit against Binance, as well as the CFTC suit. But the reason that relates to the criminal case is because we never really heard any resolution if they had dropped the charges or if there had been a decision not to pursue charges. We basically just got radio silence. And now we've got a report, okay, which, you know, you still have to be careful because there's questions as to what the source of this report is from, and where is it coming from? You know, the DOJ, if you ask anyone from the Department of Justice, what's the status of the Binance investigation? Typically what they say is, we don't know. They're saying, we can't tell you. It's an active investigation. Things are developing.
They're not going to comment.
So the real question is, Exactly. So the real question, Patrick, is, you know, what is the source of this information? And if you look at the AP report, the Bloomberg report, it said it's citing a source familiar with the investigation, said the long-running government probe was nearing a conclusion, but did not give specific information on penalties or exact time frame. That's interesting, right? Because who is that? Who would be the person that would actually have a source within the government? Because I would bet that it's not one of the prosecutors. It's not one of the high profile individuals. It's probably someone adjacent to that team, or potentially it's Binance themselves, right? They want to get out in front of this. There's an argument to be made that Binance is purposely leaking this story, knowing that an indictment may be pending. And they're just trying to basically paint this. Think about it from an optic standpoint, right? Sure. They're trying to paint this as a shakedown from the U.S. government as opposed to what it is, which is serious criminal charges. So if you were Binance and you wanted to get out in front of this, you would leak this story out there and try to paint it off as almost like a quasi-civil case where all that's really we're talking about is money, when in reality, it could be something far more serious. So it's really important from this standpoint to sort of be careful about, you know, why this is being leaked, what the narrative is, what the idea is. And the tweet I made, which is that I just doubt Binance is going to fork over $4 billion at this point to resolve this, is really focused on two things. Number one, it's focused on I don't believe that anyone without seeing specific charges, without seeing an indictment and a criminal case is just going to pay a penalty. I could be wrong. That's a serious monetary penalty. $4 billion.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Even in today's days with inflation, right? That's not chump change. It's possible, right? It's possible that they could go out and pay that. But, you know, we have to be careful that in just assuming it is the case. But the second reason I think it's probably more interesting is because of the way in which the DOJ communicates. This is atypical for how they would communicate and how an important source close to an investigation would leak this information. So got to be careful with making too many conclusions right here. My guess is that this is front running, and this is just a guess, my speculation, I'll qualify that. I think this is front running some type of indictment that is coming down the pipe.
I'd say this. I mean, when you say about being careful about speculation, you're right. But particularly in the crypto space, anybody that's followed this for a while, and especially on the unique world that is crypto Twitter, right, within the Twitterverse, people love speculation. They love and one of the things that has amazed me is a source. What was the thing with BlackRock and the XRP? I mean, anybody that's a source said or I heard or my brother's uncle's neighbor told me, people run with it, right? And they love to just retweet it.
Did you know, Pat, how that actually developed? What the backstory was about that filing that was made?
I thought somebody basically just kind of did something or did a news article or just kind of registered something and did it, or what exactly?
Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, it is amazing. This is why you have to, you know, what's the old saying? Believe
half of it.
Well, trust, verify, but also, you know, believe half of what you see and none of what you hear, right? Like, in this case, somebody apparently went on the filing website and actually filed a document that purported to be from BlackRock. It wasn't just a made up screenshot. They actually went and filed something.
You could file anything. Right. Yeah.
And they filled in the information and made it look like BlackRock. And then anybody who went to the website would suddenly think it was real. Right. And then apparently, according to, you know, some folks close to BlackRock, they have actually reported this. They referred this to the authorities for further investigation. But just think about how crazy that is. That's a world where the slightest little nugget of information can cause, you know, huge ripples in the price. And in more well-defined markets, if you pulled off any of that BS, you would be indicted overnight, right? Like the authorities would be all over you.
Yeah, you know, and I want to share some too, because we have worldwide listeners, obviously, and worldwide people watching the podcast. And of course, we're talking particularly within the United States here about the legal system. And I want to say something, and as an attorney, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe that anybody could file anything. Right? It doesn't mean that, because a lot of times somebody will say, oh, I saw a filing in XYZ company filed. That doesn't mean it's approved. And I'm talking whatever the governmental agency might be correct. But I mean, anybody could pretty much, it could be accepted for filing, right? And whatever it might be, that doesn't mean it's granted.
Correct. 100%. You can file a lawsuit that says, you know, an alien stole my car, right? That doesn't mean it's a valid lawsuit. File it. All the filing means is literally somebody in the old days, we used to walk down to the courthouse and file it. Now it's even easier, right? It's just a drag and drop a PDF into an e-file system and it goes online. Now, I will say there are serious penalties for filing a document in the court system that does not have a reasonable factual basis. There's standards in every single jurisdiction that if you're filing something that's entirely frivolous and has no facts behind it, lawyers can lose their license for that. Right. But I will say there's plenty of cases where it's a gray area where, you know, there's suits filed all the time against clients, some of whom I represent, where the claims are extremely dubious. They don't really have a whole lot of factual background. And the way you deal with that is a motion to dismiss. Okay. So right now, your listeners be interested in this. SEC. Right. Part of our nation's government, part of the United States government, right? The regulatory branch tasked with enforcing securities. Well, just because they filed a complaint against Coinbase, saying they're not lawfully able to operate as an exchange and a clearinghouse and a broker dealer. Doesn't mean it's the truth, right? Doesn't mean it's right. The case. What has to happen is it needs to go before a judge. The judge looks at the evidence, looks at the allegations, and the judge will decide as a matter of law whether that complaint can withstand a motion to dismiss. And Coinbase, for its part and for its lawyers, they've said, we think we're going to win. We think we're going to get this case dismissed that's brought against the about the SEC. And for those that think the government's always got, you know, all the cards and they always come loaded to bear, just look at the result in the Ripple Labs case, right? The Ripple Labs case, the government went through years of protracted litigation. They thought they had an extremely strong case, and they lost on several of the claims that were made in that case. That just shows you that, everybody says, well, the SEC says this or the SEC says that. Well, there's only one body that could sit declare whether something's a security. Do you know what that is?
What's that?
The courts. Yes.
Yeah, no, I just that brings in actually my next question on that, because somebody from Amsterdam the other day I was talking with, and he's asked me a question. I'm not an attorney. I can answer this. And he said to me, well, so, you know, talking about the court case and the judge in New York on those cases. And he said, is that basically going to be final? And I was kind of hard for me to answer that. But let me ask you this. You obviously saw that, paying attention, all that. Is that final, or what's the next step after that? Or does the SEC appeal that, or did they kind of say, hey, look, OK, this is going to be at least the law of the land for now?
It's another thing we don't really know, right? We get to see if they're going to try and go for an appeal. They did sort of try to broker a deal to call off the trial. So that's still pending. We're watching that closely. But to your point, right, like the key issue is, you know, even when a court rules that something is or is not an investment contract or security, there's still an appellate process. And guess what? If that court doesn't agree with it, there's plenty of time where issues that are new and novel, they go up even higher. We have a system of appeals in the United States where there's sort of a check and balance, right? The higher court can review the lower court's decision and decide these things. And I know some legal commentators were speculating that the reason the SEC dropped its case effectively against Brad Garlinghouse and Chris Larson in the Ripple Labs case was because they want to get that case up to the appellate court so someone can review it and potentially, change their result. But an important thing to remember about that case is that, you know, when you're dealing with securities, when you're dealing with investment contracts and how to analyze them under the law, they're very fact specific, which means that just because in the limited circumstance of the Ripple case meant that the court found there wasn't a sale of a securities for the programmatic sales, doesn't mean that all tokens out there and everything out there isn't a security. In fact, I would argue the opposite. There have been other cases where other courts have found that, you know, things were securities and were investment contracts. So you have this approach where every token effectively is being analyzed on a case-by-case basis, which is the SEC's preferred route of handling this industry. But logistically, what it does is it just causes a heck of a lot of confusion, and market participants really don't know what to make of it. And everybody's forced to become like a quasi-legal commentator to sort of analyze and interpret all this stuff, right?
Especially on Twitter, right?
Well, and the same thing goes, it's kind of, I sit back and I kind of laugh sometimes listening to all the chatter and back and forth about the ETF, because there is so much confusion about the process for the Bitcoin spot ETF and what needs to take place and where we're at in it. And, that confusion, people are feeding off it, and they're moving the price around based on the tiniest bit of news that comes down, a little drip that comes down in the form of a filing.
Right. Well, so let me ask you, because I want to get to the ETFs in a second, because I definitely want to ask you about that. But when it comes to the court system in New York, could that be appealed to the Supreme Court at some point? I mean, could it actually go that high?
You're talking about the Ripple Labs case?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It can go. I mean, now to keep in mind, the chances of getting a case to the U.S. Supreme Court are extremely small. Right. I checked, they accept like of all cases filed, it's like 0.0001% of all cases filed. So it's almost infinitesimal, right? But theoretically, if it's an issue as of the kind of importance that this case is drawn, and it's a novel important issue, there's no reason why if they lose in the appellate court, whoever loses, it can't be appealed again. And that happens frequently.
Right. Okay. So when it comes to on the ETF end, I want to ask you about that, but I'm going to start with from a legal aspect here, or question about this is, when you look at the ETFs right now and they have to list a custody provider and they list Coinbase, yet the SEC is suing Coinbase. I believe also when the government sells Bitcoins, they sell through Coinbase. From a legal point of view, when you look at that, how do you feel about Coinbase, you know, being subject of litigation, yet Coinbase is being listed in all these filings? And once again, with BlackRock, Dell, I mean, these are the largest assets, under management. Not to say this is the ones that make the decision when it comes to Congress or whatnot, ultimately with the SEC. But how do you feel about Coinbase being listed as, if I'm saying that correctly, the custody provider for the ETFs?
Yes.
And the litigation aspect? Because I'm a little confused by that, how that can happen.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And you should be confused because it's an inconsistent position, right? And this is the problem with the SEC, I think. And I know folks there, quite closely. And I don't mean in any way to be overly critical because it is a tough job. But I will tell you that if you're being objective, Pat, and you're just looking at what they've done, I think that the general public, as well as the courts, the judges that are reviewing what they've done, have a right to criticize them for being inconsistent in their approach. Okay, starting with the approval of the futures ETF. If you believe that the spot market of Bitcoin is somehow prone to manipulation or it is not safe for customers to trade in, then why did they approve a Bitcoin futures ETF? Which, by the way, the court noted in the case, the Grayscale case that was brought, the court noted that there's a 99% correlation between the futures price and the spot price. Mm-hmm. So to me, it would never made a lot of logical sense to sort of treat the markets differently. We're going to let the futures ETF forward, but we're not going to let the spot ETF. That's an inconsistent position. And the same is true of what you're raising. I raise that because you brought up yet another issue. There is a case pending right now that says Coinbase, you cannot engage as an exchange because you don't have the proper registration or a broker dealer or a clearinghouse. And we want you to get registered. And if you don't, we are going to seek an order, an injunction from the court barring you from operating. That's pending right now, that case. Right. So for them to turn around and then now subject retail participants to a Bitcoin spot ETF where the underlying is a custody provider that can't actually operate according to the SEC would be inconsistent. They're kind of in a trick bag. And I think this is the result of the approach they've taken with the industry. Their approach has been not to think globally, not to think comprehensively, but to handle all these things in a piecemeal fashion. And the reason for that, Pat, is because ultimately you got to remember the tenure of, you talked about 9 years of developing crypto, of crypto industry. The tenure of the SEC chairs aren't 9 years. They're sort of, I mean, you had Jay Clayton and then you go to Gensler and they have slightly different views, right? And you've had other folks in there, other directors that have come and gone. Director Hinman most famously gave that speech that everybody always talked about, how an asset can become sufficiently decentralized, talking about Ethereum. You've had a changing of the guard, which has led to inconsistent policies. And whenever there's inconsistent policies that are taking place, that's a dangerous place to be in for a regulator. Regulators are supposed to clearly communicate what is and is not permitted. And to your point, we're going to see how they're going to be able to do a pivot or some sort of sidestep or some sort of explanation for why they would eventually green light the spot ETF, but also have this case against Coinbase. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe their plan is to somehow resolve the case with Coinbase before they actually green light the spot ETF. Yeah. It's possible. You know, we're not in those conversations, unfortunately.
You know, it's interesting because I've said this on podcast previously, you know, tweeted out, you know, I a few years ago came across Gary Gensler's talks at MIT. And if you watch those, then he knows blockchain. He knows crypto. I mean, I made a comment one time. He talked about blockchain like a guy would at 2 o'clock in the morning getting pizza after being out drinking. Like, it just loves it, you know. And then watching how he's been as a regulator, I think anybody, once you're in a regulatory position, you're supposed to leave your personal biases out, right, and do whatever the agency's going to do. And so I think to some people that followed his career before, it's been a little surprising to see. Now, not to get into Democrats, Republicans, whatever party you may be, I think in general, though, people in the crypto industry, right, we just want regulation. We want clarity. And so I'd like to ask you one thing on that, too, is that for people that are, because, as you know, a lot of worldwide people that pay attention to the space and follow it, ultimately, they say, or they ask, and I get the question all the time, and I'm sure you do, too, is it going to be the SEC to regulate it? Is it going to be CFTC? Or does ultimately Congress have to give the regulations for them to enforce? Ultimately, how do you see regulate? And it's really kind of a wide-ranging question, but how do you see regulations coming in this space, from where and in what direction, with all that being said?
Yeah, that's great. Let me just comment briefly on your first remarks about, you know, Gensler. Chair Gensler is a very bright person. Okay. Never mistake him as being not somebody who understands the space. He does. I think he understands it better than the vast majority of people out there in government. The problem is, or reality is, however you want to put it, is that when you get to high levels of the government, it becomes less about what you said, which is just, you know, do the right thing, apply the law. It becomes more about politics. And if you're an ambitious person in Washington, you kind of have to read the political tea leaves. You have to kind of position yourself. And I think Gensler believes that his best chance at another government position in a Democratic administration or in any administration is for him to come out as a staunch regulator, you know, trying to get a control of this industry. I think he needs to win over the Senator Elizabeth Warrens of the world and try to have them in his corner. So leave that as it may. To your broader question, okay, the SEC's authority to regulate, okay, their authority to bring securities violations comes from Congress. It always starts with Congress, and it starts, you know, with whether you're talking about the 33 Act or any other act that was passed by Congress. It gives them the legal ability to bring suits, to bring enforcement actions, to claim something is or is not a security or is not an investment contract. That statutory authority comes from Congress. And the problem we have is that there's a very old statutory authority that has been put in place, and they're using that, you know, old 20th century model to apply it to a totally new industry where it doesn't really fit, doesn't really hold true to what the earlier standard was. So how do you fix that? Well, in my view, and this is where I'll tell you my personal opinion, I don't think you can use those laws. I think they are too antiquated and too ill-equipped to get control of this case. You're not going to be able to file cases against 10,000 token issuers over the next 10 years and have the manpower and logistical bandwidth to have all that litigation. And that's really all the SEC can do. A lot of people think the SEC can quote unquote just shut it down or stop it. But I think what the VCs and smarter folks in the space realize is that the SEC comes forward with litigation that can last 2 or 3 years. And by the time that's done, they will have made so much money they can defend against any of these claims against the against them. So to your point, I think the way you get the control, if you want to, you know, have a more orderly process and you want to have clarity, it has to come through Congress. Now, what's the problem there? The problem, Patrick, is that we have a dysfunctional Congress, and we have a Congress that, you know, I think is deeply divided over pretty much anything, including its approach to cryptocurrency. And this is one of the actually kind of sadder things from my perspective, is that I think increasingly, as years go by, and I've said this publicly, I think the whole industry, the crypto industry, the Bitcoin industry as a whole, is being increasingly viewed as partisan, right? You've got folks on one aisle that are sort of more skeptical, and you've got folks that are more free market based that are far more open to it. And what that's doing, like everything else in our politics, is causing a gridlock where you're not going to really have much push through the Congress until you get one party to take, you know, full control of everything, and then maybe they could ram something through. But, you know, it's anyone's guess whether that happens in the near term. That's more of a political question.
And look, and I've always said both sides, both parties play games. It is what it is. It's been like that for years, and it's going to be like that for years. It's doubt's never going to change. So getting the final thing on ETFs, I want to ask you, everybody's speculating, as I'm sure you've seen, you have a legal background, you have a law degree, which you have seen so many new legal experts, right, on crypto Twitter. Dogs, cats, avatars, who are telling you when it's going to be, who's going to tell you, right? I don't know. I said, I think it's going to be next year, but I always say my crystal ball is from Amazon. It's not arrived yet, so I don't know. Let me ask you, though, because you do have a bit of I'll say inside knowledge, but obviously you talk to people in the legal world. Do you want to go out there and speculate? Can you come out there and speculate when an ETF will be approved, or is that something you could talk about?
Yes, absolutely. So I put out threads on this as well. If you go to my Twitter at Joe Carlosari, I've sort of tried to do it. So what I think it's really important to focus on is that the timing of all this is very difficult to sort of exactly pinpoint. But what we can do is I can tell you times when it's extremely unlikely for it to be approved. That's the easier way to look at it. And the reason for that is that there's a process for these applications. There's a process for when they file the registration statements, when they amend their S-1s, when folks look at the documents, and there's something called a comment period. So, you know, here's the sequence. You had the Grayscale victory, and before the Grayscale even won its case, you had all these issuers, BlackRock included, that were filing their applications with the SEC effectively and trying to start the clock. Now, what when they file these documents, there is a statutorily defined period with which the SEC must respond, within which the SEC must respond. Once that period lapses, they get an extension. Once the second extension lapses, they get another extension, a third extension. And then they, you know, they get one more final extension. So where do we at, where are we at in the process right now? Most of the major applicants that filed back in the spring, early summer, have gone through their second period of response. They've all been kicked, including BlackRock. There was an October period where there was a second deadline, and that got kicked another set of period time. And it really is now the focal point is in January. Now, there was hope last week that you could have gotten a window where they would have approved it. And I think market participants were sort of, you know, very eager and optimistic about that period last week. And the reason for that is that during this period where they are waiting to go for their extension, there's also the comment period where, you know, they're soliciting comments from the public. You or me, we can write to the SEC and we could say, we really think you should approve the Bitcoin spot ETF. That's not going to matter, right? I really don't think the comments matter. It's not going to push the needle one way or the other to approve it. It's not going to sway. But the reason why I focus a lot on the comment period, Patrick, is because if you if you're the SEC and you say, members of the public, you have until X date to submit a comment, it's very unlikely in my mind that they would just ignore their own comment period and just approve the ETF, right? They're going to let the end of that period expire. They're going to let all the comments in. And when all of the different applications have gone through that comment period, then they're going to, you know, do a shotgun approach. They're going to approve all the applications at once. So where does that leave us? Well, you now have various different comment periods for some of the ETFs that continue to develop through this end of this month and into next month. And really the only window that would make sense for them, the earliest window for them that would make sense to approve it would probably be in mid-January, starting on the 10th, I believe. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to approve it on the 10th. They could delay it further. It could be, you know, a few months after that. They could seek another extension to the final extension in March. It's possible, right? Nobody knows. Sure. But I wouldn't, if you saw any headline tomorrow or next week that said spot ETF approved, I would be highly skeptical that is a real headline, just because it wouldn't make sense given the process, which is very orderly, that the SEC likes to take.
But wait. What if I see the headline that says, a source told me?
Same thing, you know, like this is
a source said, what sort? I don't know, but a source, on crypto Twitter said it, you know?
Yeah. And people are kind of making jokes of it right now. You get a bunch of people putting it out there almost every day and trying to get headlines and get clicks and whatnot. And it's only gotten worse once, you know, Twitter monetized, right? Now everybody's trying to say something crazy to get likes and comments and shares.
Look, we're in a world where getting clicks is more important than getting it right. So it's just, you know, the world in 2023. So let me ask you a couple of final questions. When you're going out to eat, your favorite food, what do you like to eat?
I'm you know, being in Chicago, I am a pizza fanatic. Deep dish pizza is my way to go. It's, you know, I eat and breathe that stuff. I love it. Probably not good for you, but, you know, still great. And yeah, I mean, that's my thing. And, you know, I've been spending a lot of nights recently, few months here, working pretty hard at a Bitcoin legal thriller that I'm really excited. I'll make sure you get a copy once it premieres.
Okay.
It's based on some cases and that I've worked on adjacently and sort of adapted some of the facts. And it's going to be interesting. You know, we live in a good time to sort of try to figure out, like, you know, what is going to be that critical mass? What's going to be that moment where you move from the early adopters, which I truly believe you know, crypto and Bitcoin in general are still comprised mostly of early adopters, to the masses. So it couldn't be really more exciting. I mean, that's going to be fun when we finally realize, you know, this is going to be integrated and actually become something as opposed to just talking about becoming something.
Yeah, I'll send you my address. Send me a copy. I love that.
That'd yeah, awesome. Definitely. We're cool. going to do that.
Cool. Yep. Well, I appreciate that. And how do people find you? What's the best way to connect?
Best way to connect is on Twitter. If you want to just talk about crypto or talk about anything, you know, macroeconomics, the economy, that sort of thing, I'm at Joe Carlosari. But I got to do a shameless plug. If you have a litigated matter, you know, and there's a lot of folks out there who have been wronged by bad actors in the space. I'm sure everybody's got stories of people, you know, trade my account for me, or, you know, send me 5 Bitcoin and I'll send you 20 back, that type of thing. If that's you and you've had a serious loss, you know, I do commercial litigation all the time, especially if it's with US-based actors, folks that, you know, did something wrong. And I think what we have the problem with in this space is that a lot of people, when they're scammed, when they're a victim of fraud, they sort of put their head down, feel bad about, you know, the fact that they're defrauded, when in reality, you know, there's a system for that. You can seek remedy in the courts, and you should if you've truly been a victim. So happy to help. If you want any legal advice or any regulatory issues, I do a whole host of those. You can just Google my name, Joe Carlisari, and my firm website will pop up, and you know, I'll be happy to chat with you, you know, at no cost to you about, you know, whatever issue you're going through.
Do you want to give your email out, or just go to the website, go to your Twitter website, best way?
I'll give the email out. It's a long one. It's J Carlisari, JCARLASARE at AmundsenDavisLaw.com. AmundsenDavisLaw.com. It's a longer one. Okay. But if you Google me, I'll come up right at the top of your search results, and my email is on the website.
Okay. And I know with Twitter, like we've interacted on Twitter. I followed you for a while, and you've been really, you know, great to touch base with. So I appreciate it. So,
yeah, no, I appreciate it. And you know, I really think that it's an exciting time. It's great you're doing the podcast, and it's great, you know, you're trying to get people on that I think are knowledge and subject matter experts, which is really, really key. There's a lot, it's confusing, Patrick, for a lot of people in the space, because they feel like to your point earlier, everybody's an overnight expert on whatever issue of the day is, you know, consuming the narrative. Yeah. So really follow people that know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. It's nice to talk to somebody that actually knows legal, as opposed to just saying it and people that are tweeting it. But that's why I wanted to have you on. And first time I've had somebody on to talk legal. So I appreciate you taking the time, Joe.
Awesome. Anytime. Let me know. Okay.
All right. This is the latest episode of the Big Dog Crypto Podcast.
You've been listening to the Big Dog Crypto Podcast. Follow on Twitter at Woof Big Dog, Woof Big DAWG, and run faster than the competition. Woof, woof.